Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1. With Opel and the all-new Opel Astra. German engineering at its core. It's our most efficient Astra yet.
Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1.
Very important text message to read to you now. In Donegal, we are refusing to accept the result of yesterday's game and will appeal the outcome all the way to the Supreme Court if necessary. If the game had been stopped at half-time, we would have won. The fact that no Donegal people were allowed anywhere close to the game to observe only raises questions as to the legitimacy of the result. Donegal will refuse to concede as Ulster champions until this is reviewed. Well, Kevin, we are working on getting Rudy Giuliani's phone number for you and we will send it on as soon as we do. The voice you hear laughing in the background is Peter Sheridan, and Peter is here to talk to us about our next topic, because last month we talked about the relationship between mothers and daughters, and today we're talking about the bond between fathers and sons. Maybe you're a son who feels emotionally distant from his father and would like to reconnect, or maybe you're a father who feels his teenage son doesn't respect or listen to him anymore. Well, we have advice from family psychotherapist Madeline Connolly and playwright Peter Sheridan, as I said, who has four children. Peter, two of them are boys and two are girls. So you have experience on both sides of this. If you've any questions, by the way, you get them into us on 51551 or email todaycb@rte.ie. Madeline, I'm going to start with you first, because you're treating fathers and sons in your practice when problems arise. So they're coming to you when, not that it's too late, but there's an issue.
Yeah, I suppose fathers have come to me for a number of different reasons. You might have a young man whose father might have been part of his life when he was younger and then left his life at some point, and he's now thinking, how am I going to resolve this with myself to be a better father for my own child? So that's a really nice place to start with a young father, a potential father, because he can kind of understand the story of his own father and maybe make some sense of it before he too then goes into that role and that relationship with his child.
And you're finding some fathers would like to rewrite the script that they experienced in their own relationship with their father.
Absolutely. I mean, that's a very common situation that we as systemic psychotherapists would see, is that fathers, you know, who are very determined to be a different kind of presence in their own children's lives, in their own sons' lives, don't always want to replicate, you know, what they had from their own experiences with their father, and may want to correct some of those scripts. They might take what's good from those relationships, but also think, well, I don't want to be like that. I want to be closer to my son. I want to be more involved in his life.
Okay.
So that's where they can have the space to do that, yeah.
Peter, you had a great relationship with your father, is that right?
Yeah, complex, but great. He was a great father, you know.
Were you his favourite?
Probably, yeah. Well, I was his messenger.
Okay.
In those days, back in the 50s when I was growing up, people had roles in the family. We were seven kids, six boys and a girl. And I was my dad's messenger, which meant that I got sent places largely that he wouldn't go himself, and up on the bike and out into the streets of Dublin, and, you know, got to know all the back streets and alleyways in Dublin. And my dad used to say, if Dublin was a woman, he'd marry her. He loved the city. He loved everything about it. And I inherited that love from him. So he was flamboyant. He was bohemian. He was eccentric. And he was maddening. Like, when he got ideas into his head about things, there was nothing you could do to shake him. So as a boy growing up, I ran into walls with my dad. You know, you'd run into arguments with my father that were unresolvable and you'd want to kill him. You know, the Greek thing of wanting to kill your father, wanting to get rid of that force that's in your way, this kind of incredible force that's in your way. Most manifest, I mean, the one I always remember is the rows over Top of the Pops on the TV.
We all had those. Yeah, come on, tell me about your rows and I'll tell you about mine.
Well, the ones over Top of the Pops is my dad would be saying things like, the Beatles don't play their own instruments.
Yeah.
You know, that's all made up. That's all done on tape machines. There's nothing about that that's real. Now, I was learning guitar at the time. I knew they played their own guitars. So I would be going crazy with my dad trying to say to him, no, they do play their own instruments. So we would have that tussle, that tension all the time going on.
They probably were miming on Top of the Pops.
Yeah, but he actually meant that they didn't play, that the recordings were fake.
Yeah, I know. But he was kind of both right on that one.
He was taking it a kind of a stage further, you know.
And did you feel then there came a point where you had to sort of push back against him to show that I'm my own person here?
Very much so. When I got married was the big conflict. I got married at 19. I was very young. I was just starting college. And my father, because I was underage, he had to sign the papers. And he wouldn't sign the papers unless I agreed to live at home. And Sheila, my wife, would live in her family home.
Mm-hmm.
I said, sure, what's the point in getting married if we're doing that, Dad? That's silly. Well, that's the way I would like it. That's the way I'd like it to be. Now, his thing was kind of born out of one, a pride in me that I had made it to college on a scholarship, but his disappointment that I was going to blow it, you know, that this wasn't going to work out. I wasn't going to be able to be a married man and look after my wife and the baby that was expected and be a college student. And he had great hopes for me on that level academically. You know, I was reasonably good in school and he thought I was really bright and, you know, being his favourite, he wanted me to kind of, you know, get to the highest level possible. So there was a huge tension around all of that, you know, and I had to stand up to him and say no. And then when we did get married, obviously the idea was that we would probably live in my house, in my family home, but me and Sheila had no interest in that whatsoever. So we got a mobile home, like a glorified caravan, and we lived in that for the first 3.5 years, and we had the best time ever living in there. We loved our little mobile home, our little caravan, and that was our place to go to. And it was great, you know, yeah. It was the start of our marriage, and it was me standing up to my dad and saying, no, I'm going to do this my way.
I'd say that's a common enough story, Madeline, is it, that people have to push back?
Yeah. And even, you know, when you think of Peter's story there, I mean, maybe, you know, in his father's time, he had a very prescribed role, possibly, that he was the breadwinner. And it was the burden of the father in those days to be the breadwinner and to bring home the bacon, so to speak. So they weren't really allowed to have a life for themselves in terms of being, you know, being even involved in the family very much. They left the house for very long hours. So maybe he just wanted something different there, you know, for his son. But of course, it's a healthy conflict to have to do what you need to do as an adult son and move away from your parents. And there has to be conflict in that. It would seem normal to me.
And the role of the father has changed quite a lot, hasn't it, from the times we were talking about there with Peter's dad?
The role of the father has changed unbelievably since, you know, the 40s and 50s. And then, you know, in the 50s, you know, then it was very much based on authoritarian and wait till your father gets home and obedience and put, no, nothing. All fathers were like that. But that was the kind of role that was expected of them. And then that kind of swung. I mean, this is why it's so difficult for parents today, I think. It swung to the other side of things in the 60s and 70s to the more permissive style of parenting, saying, well, we know authoritarianism isn't okay. So maybe the permissive style, you see, this is where we're all parenting in the context of what's going on socially, culturally, and every other way, you know, in our lives. And the permissive style didn't work either. So then it swung back to the middle, where we have a new authority now, where we know young people and children need limits. We know that we need to do that fathers need to do that in their roles. But we know also they can do that in a respectful and nurturing and kind and compassionate way. So that's hopefully where we are today with all of that, if that makes any sense to everyone.
Peter.
Yeah, one of the things when I was a kid growing up that my dad was really, really stringent about was that we all ate together. We all sat down at the table for our dinner and we sat down at the table for our tea. And that went every day. And my dad loved that because all of the topics of the day would be discussed and everything would be up for grabs. And amazing things happened. I remember one Friday lunchtime where everybody had fish and chips on a Friday and we were sitting down, tucking into our fish and chips when a cow came into the kitchen. An actual cow, because we lived on the track where the live cattle went down to the boats bound for England. Now, when a cow comes into your kitchen, you realise how big it is. And my father jumped under the table, I ran up the stairs, and my ma took out a dishcloth and backed the cow out the door of the kitchen, back out onto the street. So my ma, in a way, became the hero of the family. And my father was always mortified when people brought up the day ma got the cow, backed the cow out of the kitchen, because it robbed him of his heroic role.
I see some questions and comments coming in for you here. And
can
this,
I just comment?
Yes, of course. Yeah, go ahead.
Claire, what Peter's saying, you know, that we know now, you know, that promoting healthy activities and family time with young people and children is definitely, you know, a good mediator for all the other things that parents struggle with. And I mean, for Peter's family to have been able to do that, it's certainly something we need to bring into our lives today, if in any way possible that we can, those important times.
This listener says to us, when you see your son making the same mistakes as you when you were young, and you're very hard on him because of this, mistakes, that's too hard a word, says this listener, it's a lack of focus in particular, picking up bad habits instead of good, he's a little bit absent-minded, like you know who. So this child is acting exactly as the dad did. He's a really good chap. I know I should take it easy on him, but I still verbally let fly. Have you any advice?
Absolutely. I mean, this is coming from a very caring father. You know, he just wants his son to not maybe make the mistakes or get distracted like he did. And I think the thing is not to get on at him too much about it, to say, I notice, what would help? You know, I was a bit like that as a kid, and this is what helped me. To sort of go in at that approach rather than feel he's getting on his case all the time, which will, of course, just become white noise at some point, but also maybe push his son away a bit, you know? Mm-hmm. So to find a way to go about it that's helpful and supportive for his son, I think.
Did you do that with your boys, Peter? You know, don't make the mistakes I did.
No, that wouldn't have been a thing for me at all. I mean, the classic story for me with my eldest son, Rossa, was when he came to me and said that he was going to start going to the disco down in Clontarf, down to the Grove Disco, and me and Sheila sort of said, that's terrific, we're really happy about that. And who will you be going? We'll be going with a couple of lads from school, and that was great. So the deal was either Sheila or myself would drive him and drop him a couple of streets away from the disco so he could meet his friends and then walk to the disco. So he did that for 3-4 years, every Saturday night, and then my son went to live in San Francisco. I had been living in San Francisco for years and was coming home for Christmas when I noticed RTE were doing a programme about the Grove Disco, a documentary, and I thought, wow, there's a great Christmas present for my son when he comes back. So I recorded it. He got home at Christmas and we gave him the tape, and he didn't seem particularly interested in it anyway, but he stayed over the whole Christmas and he hadn't looked at it, and I was very disappointed that he wasn't, wow, this is great, Dad, that was a great thing you did. So the night before he was going back, I said, you never looked at your tape. He said, Dad, do you want the truth? I never went to the Grove.
What was he doing?
So when I dropped him on the Saturday night, he used to meet his mates and go into town to a
fair
pub,
play
to a rock club.
And you never knew.
And I never knew. And this was the revelation. And you know what? I was delighted.
Were you?
I was actually really proud of him, that he found a way to do what he needed to do at 14, 15, because he was really into music. And we had a great laugh about it, you know, but it was a real one of those shockers where I was actually surprised.
Yeah, but you
but
see,
at the same time,
can I say to you, Madeline, that if you found that out at the time it was happening, you mightn't think it was so funny or entertaining. Do you know what I mean? If he was 14.
I mean, it's great not to have known, isn't it? Because he got through it and parents got through it and nobody was injured. You know, he survived it. So, I mean, it's sometimes that information is great not to have. Unfortunately, parents, I suppose, they get very, very anxious. And I mean, look, it's a time of risk-taking behaviours, and maybe, I don't know, but maybe it's fair to say that now maybe the risks are greater. I don't know how Peter would feel if his grandsons were doing the same things in today's context. That's the difference, isn't it? What do you think, Peter?
I loved your response. The not knowing was great. You have to give kids a lot of rope.
Yeah.
You know, you have to trust that by giving them a good deal of rope, that they will choose to do the right thing ultimately, you know. They may be doing the wrong thing for a while, but they will ultimately do the right thing. Yeah. And in a way, there's a trust thing involved in it. It's like a trust game.
It's easier said than done. I've got to leave it there, but it's been fascinating talking to you both, Madeline and Peter. And if you want to listen back, don't forget that all of our items are available at rte.ie/podcast.